So one thing I want to mention is that Ines and I met like just on the basis of being German, which was interesting. And so we had a coffee years ago now, and then we discovered that actually much of the work that Ines is doing is very correlated to Wentworth. And so Ines actually ended up writing just recently a case study about a German university and Wentworth Institute of Technology, which we're more than happy to share with you. And that was really just interesting to get to know a little bit more of the work that you are doing. And so I'm really pleased to have you here. And we are trying to ask our guests always like a set of similar questions. So we have perhaps at the end like some comparative structures. So I would love to hear, like in this very unprecedented time, like describe how COVID has actually upended your life, and how are you feeling about the future at the moment?
Yeah, excellent question. But let me start by saying it's such a pleasure to be here with you and with all the students. I wish I could see all of you guys. I heard wonderful things about you. Monique speaks so highly about Wentworth students. I actually had an opportunity to speak with some of you also in the context of the study I did, and I was very impressed. So it's an honor for me to be here with you. And yeah, in terms of COVID, I mean, it's obviously a crisis, right? We are in the midst of a crisis. And I think sometimes it's easy to forget that because, somehow we all need to just sort of go on with our lives. But this is really, this is a crucial moment we're living through. And I think, in some years we look back at that and say, do you remember 2020, maybe 2021, 22? We don't know how long this lasts. This was a crazy time. And again, I think the important part is also to realize that it is affecting so many people in so many different ways and in ways that we can't even imagine. So while I'm a generally very optimistic person and I believe we get through this, I am concerned by what I see, and less my life than what I see in other people's lives. And to be honest, I think the federal government's response has not alleviated some of my concerns, much more the contrary. And so, yeah, that's how I think about it. Concern, but sort of a hint of optimism.
Yeah, and I think it's also interesting to see on an international level how different countries are dealing with the crisis, just to also be able to compare notes, even so, there are different parameters at play, but it's still quite an interesting time. I find it curious when people suggest that we should use those stay-at-home orders as a way of picking up a new hobby. Because certainly I don't find that I have particularly time for this at all, as our personal and professional spheres are converging. Are there any rituals or anything that you've picked up or any habits you picked up over the course of this stay-at-home order?
I think you're so right, Monique, to point this out. So I'm a training specialist, right? I'm always interested in the question of training, education, how we can upskill, how we can make ourselves smarter, better, what have you. And yet I get very frustrated when I hear people say, oh, just use all that free time to, whatever, learn a language or pick up salsa dancing or what have you. Salsa anyways doesn't work, but whatever it is, because this kind of advice discards the fact that a lot of us have many responsibilities. And obviously, you and I are mothers. That being a parent comes with a lot of responsibility, and that in and by itself, is something that stops you from, just seizing all the endless opportunities that are presumably out there. Other people have other issues. I have a lot of single friends, and talking about routines, I made it a habit, to call some kind of single friend at least, every other day, to make sure that they're okay, because a lot of them feel very lonely, very isolated. So I think that is definitely sort of something that I've started to do for myself. Also, I go for a walk twice a day with my child, just to get out and have, sort of a moment to reflect on everything that is happening. And I think what you just alluded to, namely that international dimension, is really helpful there. So I think a lot about, and I speak a lot also with my friends, you know, on Zoom or on FaceTime or wherever, about how they are doing in their respective countries. And in a way, we sort of compare our notes as to what can be done and what should be done. So these are habits that I've developed.
Yeah, it's fascinating to see how we are adjusting in terms of communication styles to different mm-hmm. modes. Because certainly, you know, in the past, it was just so easy to stop by a friend's house. And now that is not an option anymore. So we have to figure out workarounds and also how we teach or how we show up in our professional lives. It has changed quite a bit. How have you found like efficiency as part of that process when you're teaching your classes or when you're interacting with your colleagues? Can you share any tips?
Yeah, I think scheduling has become sort of really important in the sense that I'm trying to have breaks. Yeah, I'm a bit of a workaholic, I'll be honest on that, in that regard. So I tended to always have, you know, too much on my plate. And I think it's very easy to do that also sort of in the digital area sphere now as we're communicating through these meetings, etc. So what I'm trying to do is, I already mentioned those two walks I do with my child, and I try to have them as sort of important points in the day that I don't touch. Similarly in the evening, so as of 8 or 9 o'clock, depending, you know, on the day, I just try not to work anymore. And that is actually something that I find really helpful to have a bit of a schedule here. Just in order not to be so overloaded, you know, with everything. Yeah, and then in terms of just the digital sort of communication component, I actually have to say, obviously, you know, we all miss our friends, we all miss sort of human-to-human contact, but I found that it is actually, you can make a point also in your professional life about learning about others, in learning about other people's lives. So every meeting I have, I'll take a couple of moments or minutes, you know, no matter how sort of stringent my schedule, and if I only have half an hour, then I only have half an hour. But the first 2 or 3 minutes, I will always ask, how are you doing? What is on your mind? You know, and not because it's something that they recommend as a conversation starter, but because I'm really interested in how they're feeling. And I feel it also helps sort of understand then the discussion or the conversation that follows afterwards. You know, when it's a work discussion, if I know that person has been really stressed, say a colleague of mine, husband just started a new job and the sort of safety protection measures are just not in place, and she's really worried about her husband's health, then I know that anything that will come afterwards is somehow, you know, shaped by this general anxiety that she has. And it helps me be more empathetic. And I think that is something that we really should develop in the workplace now, especially with regard to, you know, a crisis that affects us all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good point. Our students put together last week team videos where they introduced themselves, and it was very interesting to see the different contexts in which they are living and, you know, or where they chose to actually make the video, just to understand a little bit more about those personal facets. I think it's becoming more important, like focusing on the human side of humans. Absolutely. You know, is absolutely useful. Let's dive into the future of work, because you've spent a number of years in that space. And so what does that mean to you? Future of work sounds important.
So to me, future of work actually means an opportunity to ask really interesting questions about relationships as we see a change in the workplace and so the economy, if you want. And it sounds like a pretty big statement, but it really breaks down to relationships in 3 categories. So the first bucket, if you want, or category, and I think that's what a lot of people think about when they hear the future of work, is the relationship between humans and machines. Now, that's obviously, or technology, could also say, that's obviously a very important bucket. But then there's the second bucket that I find really interesting and that I've tried to focus on more in my work, and that is the relationship between humans and work itself, work as a concept, and work as something that really sort of captures a large part of our life and often our identity. And then the third bucket is the relationship of humans and humans, or sort of humans in society, again, against this sort of changing landscape of technology. And sort of looking at these three buckets, we have, as I said earlier, a lot of sub-questions that emerge. And for me, this is an opportunity to engage with these questions and dig deeper into what I find interesting.
Now, David Autor just called COVID-19 an automation forcing event. And you just brought up, you know, the relationship between humans and machines. And of course, that has always been part of the conversation before, that robotics, AI, you know, they're going to take jobs away. Has the pandemic, you think, accelerated that process?
So I think time will tell whether it has or not. What I find interesting, and I mean, David is brilliant, right? So, you know, I'm sure he and many of my colleagues are already sort of designing or implementing studies in this regard to see what is really happening there in terms of sort of automation acceleration. But to me, the COVID-19 crisis is actually more interesting with regards to the second and third bucket that I was speaking about, and less so the automation one, because if we look at sort of the headlines, if we see where discourse is going, you know, it really is focused on discussions about essential workers, what they bring to our lives, what they're being paid, under which conditions they work. It is about our relationship to work. I mean, you started off asking me all these questions, right? How do you organize yourself? How do you work these days? So questions such as remote work, flexible work arrangements, etc. How you give workers a voice in relationship to, say, management. These questions are, to me, the more interesting ones, and also not just more interesting, they're also the ones that we have seen sort of bubble up in the COVID-19 pandemic. So as much as David's comment on automation is relevant, we don't have the studies yet. I'm really looking forward to seeing them. But what we see just in terms of public discourse is a growing relevance of the second and third bucket.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you that the pandemic definitely has shown that there is a huge inequality. We had a speaker yesterday who was touching upon that quite a bit. And it also kind of draws the parallel to countries like Denmark or any of the other Scandinavian countries, where definitely the support systems for workers is much, much differently. I know you've been working across continents and different mm-hmm. Countries. Can you share a little bit more of what the US could learn in that regard?
Yeah, so I find it difficult to say, you know, countries should learn, because every country is unique in its institutions, in its history, in its mindset. People have a different mindset. But what I definitely would say is that the institutional response, and this is, again, also something that I sort of alluded to at the very beginning of our conversation, is has been less than optimal. Information has not flown freely. There has been a disrespect for science, for scientists, for factual information. People have been let go who, you know, sort of confronted this topic, and this is definitely something that I've seen less in Europe, and also just the very speed with which the response has been taken. So that is definitely something that I think the United States could learn, is, you know, it's a strong word, but is something that maybe other countries have done slightly better. That being said, something I always have a lot of respect for here in the United States is this, and that I think in a way, you know, the other side could learn, is this sort of initiative taking, and this belief that somehow it will end up okay, you know, somehow we're going to get out of the crisis, and actually not just somehow, but that we all need to make an effort into doing that. And, you know, we see that with sort of an increased interest now in joining the voluntary national service. You know, the National Guard has been extremely active. You know, there are so many people who have ideas and as to how they, you know, could contribute to getting us out of the crisis, even in the absence of a, I would say, efficient government response, that this is something that I see as really, you know, admirable. But again, I think the government's response has not been satisfactory.
It's interesting what you're bringing up just in terms of jumping in and taking action and initiative, because it's definitely, we've seen just on a smaller scale, right, from a face shield perspective. I know Wentworth has been part of producing face shields for Brigham and Women's Hospital. MIT has been doing tremendous amounts of work donating shields to various hospitals around the Boston area and Massachusetts. And so, you know, I'm wondering, like, as we are finding ourselves in this situation and how we are, you know, considering the work contract that we as humans have with our work, what the relationship is there, will we actually make different choices going forward? Will we say, well, I've been commuting for an hour and a half to work. I find that totally unreasonable now, and I'm going to, you know, shift focus and do something entirely different. What do you think about that? You've touched upon that a little bit before, but would you see new models of work emerging?
Yes, I think there's definitely a window of opportunity that you also seem to be referring to that we can seize. You know, the question is whether we will, and the question is whether those of us who are aware of alternatives, of what society could look like, what political institutions could look like, what our personal life could look like, if we are willing to not just embrace that, but also promote that and lobby for that. And so there's a huge sort of space for activism, if you want, or for taking initiative, and to be honest, also showing that it works or doesn't work. I think we see that at the level of, you know, some large companies are already sort of promoting, say, remote work policies. I'm not saying that necessarily all great. You need to weigh what it means for the again, whether this will stick and under what conditions it will stick, you know, is going to be the question. But I think now is the space to sort of experiment. And I think, again, a lot of what you said earlier, but sort of looking sort of outside the United States, you know, and see what's been happening in other countries, especially European countries, you know, where the sort of the welfare state or government has played a much larger role at regulating work, for instance, is definitely helpful here. And we, you know, maybe enough of a sort of a lobby group here to push for change. I would certainly hope so, because there is a lot of room for improvement.
It is interesting if we think about it in the context of the millennial generation or Gen Z that always have been perceived as coming in, you know, pushing the boundaries of what, you know, traditional work models are. And so I think now, you know, we are also going to learn that baby boomers or, you know, our generation is also thinking much, much differently about what work could be. And it'll be interesting to see how much pushback there will be to the institutions and organizations and how the response is going to be.
Yeah, so, absolutely. I mean, I have to say, I'm a huge fan of the millennial generation. I think they're like, you guys are my hope. if you open, you know, your eyes, and I think you've already done that you know, what life could be like, what work life could be like, and you actively lobby for that, then we can definitely see a change, not only in this country, but around the world. Yeah, you guys go.
I promise. One thing I would like to throw in for the students is I think it also focuses in on what's really important in life. And, you know, how we've historically determined career pathways, you know, that might actually shift. And I think that's an important consideration to have. You know, would you care more for having social impact and really making a difference in the world, or climbing a career ladder? Both can be, of course, congruent, but don't always have to be. So I think it's going to be an interesting dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and let me just add, I think it's also very important to see, maybe not everybody wants to become, say, a social entrepreneur, right, or an activist, and that's absolutely fine. We all have our different stories, and we have different areas of interest, and if you want to have a traditional career, or say, a career in a traditional industry, you have any to do that. That being said, I think there's we can do also in traditional workplaces in order to make those work better. And again, you know, I alluded to this earlier, working towards giving workers a voice, giving employees a voice, vis-a-vis government, for instance, is incredibly interesting, important, you know. So do you hear my child cry? Because then just give me one second. I have to close the door properly and spin off. One second.
That is just like, I'm just going to stand in for here. So I've just outsourced my child to my 11-year-old. So this is what happens in real life in the COVID-19 situation.
Apologies.
No worries.
Actually, let me just say, this is quite funny because, you know, again, sort of changes since COVID-19. Like in the past, I would have been extremely embarrassed, you know, if somehow my child would have made noise. Now I'm like, sorry, child makes noise. Can't do anything about it, right? This is working from home.
I know. This is definitely considering the human side of all of us as we are showing up to work, for sure. So one question I had for you before we are wrapping up our segment is, like, we have seen that, you know, different industries have influencers, and you've been touching up on multiple different industries. I'm just wondering if you've seen how that power shift is actually emerging. So, you know, are we suddenly hearing folks' voices that haven't historically been heard? And, you know, how has that shown up in your world?
Yeah, so I would say my world is twofold, right? I work in higher education, but I deal with a lot of different industries. So let me focus on higher education first. Higher education is ultimately an industry that is changing rapidly. It has to, right? Because a lot of the sort of traditional, if you say, business model, is just not going to work anymore the way it has. If we look at sort of the traditional activities of universities, say, teaching, research, knowledge and technology transfer and outreach or service, each component will have to change, and each university or college, depending on sort of their specific mix of these elements, will have to rethink whether that model is still viable or how they can sort of alternate specific areas and maybe partner with others and sort of build a new profile, if you want. So I think that is one development that we see. And in terms of sort of who's at the forefront, I find actually that a lot of community colleges are doing a great job, you know, and that's interesting because they are the ones under most pressure, if you want. You know, you think that the sort of elite institutions, you know, with their huge endowments, have kind of the brain space to think creatively. But now it's actually often the community services and those serving sort of populations that are now most at risk that are coming up with great ideas. So I think in terms of leaders, you know, this is actually where I see the leaders, not the sort of elite institutions, not to say that they're not also having great ideas, you know, and they have the resources to put them into place. But the ideas, I think the interesting ones really come from community colleges. In terms of sort of generally changes, I do see that already before COVID-19, we saw the tech firms being very proactive in terms of coming up with alternative work models or constellations. I think that has a lot to do with the sort of supply and demand of labor. So obviously, you know, if you're competing with other firms for the best and the brightest, you want to make sure you offer them something. But also here I should warn, you know, not everything that is looks great on paper is actually, you know, great on paper. Some firms offer, for instance, limitless holidays, and studies have shown that those the people working for those companies are actually taking them up less than those with a sort of a fixed amount of holidays. So it's really important to sort of look behind the surface. Yet a lot of great ideas come out of these places. I should also say, for instance, that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has done, you know, has been at the forefront of bringing very interesting change with regard to parental leave policies. And, you know, we will see if this is something that will be taken up by sort of corporate America. But there are, you know, some leaders let go the, we call it the high road in business, you know, that really try to establish good practices for workers and bring in workers' voice again. This is a very important sort of field that actually encourage workers to share their opinions, be it, you know, with regard to the introduction of new technologies or how they can make work better for them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that. Our students are going to work towards future scenarios. And so, you know, understanding like how humans are actually going to show up in the world and what the work structure is going to look like will be important as they're creating those narratives around future scenarios. Maybe you can jumpstart their thinking a little bit. If you put your visionary hat on, like what do you think would be totally unthinkable, but plausible that could happen in the future around the future of work?
With regard to a specific industry or in general?
Just in general, when you think about the work models or the different triad that you mentioned before, the relationships between humans and machines, humans and humans and the work environment, what would you consider, mm-hmm. you know, an amazing leapfrogging that could be plausible, but seems a little crazy right now?
Yeah, I think, again, you know, a lot seems crazy in the American context, right? Doesn't mean that it's crazy elsewhere. So I think if I were, maybe this is also just a general sort of question of how I approach these things, but if I were to ask, you know, what is an innovation I want to see, I would start by identifying a specific population or a specific problem that we've seen so far. So say, families, you know, or fathers and the workplace, or it could be any, you know, anything that is of interest to you. Students who, you know, from first generations who so far haven't had access to college, you know, as easily, or whatever it is, you know, and then essential workers, and think about what are their problems, and then what could a solution look like? Now, when it comes to social entrepreneurship, it's very important also in general, like human-centered design thinking, it's very important to speak with people, right? So it's not just sort of sitting there in your sort of asylum and room and think about, oh, you know, what could this look like? But I would always say take a problem-based approach and then develop the solution, as crazy as it may be, from there. So I would say pick a population, pick a problem if you want, and then think, you know, how you can approach this population. Again, might be more difficult during a time of COVID, you know, and especially if you say essential workers, you know, it might be very difficult to get a hold of them. But thinking about what their issues are, and then speaking with them, listening carefully, and then from that develop a solution. And again, you know, I think what you sort of alluded to at the very beginning is a great piece of advice, doing your research in terms of what already exists elsewhere. And that's how I would probably go about this. So I find it difficult to give one, you know, big answer, you know, but what the future of work would look like, because I would have to break it down to specific population, specific groups, you know, that are, you know, part of this. But the list is so long, I can give you a million ideas, you know, whether it's, you know, elderly worker who are more likely to be sort of replaced, who are, or for whom it is going to be more difficult to find employment, you know, once the machines sort of have stepped in, or for whom it is just more difficult to retrain or upskill, you know, or, you know, younger people who sort of don't have a network of people who can advise them, you know, who don't have parents or family or friends who can say, you know, this is the direction to go. I would ask, you know, in terms of next steps in a career, I would think about these groups and how I can help them.
Thank you so much, Ines. Our official time is up. Is there anything that we haven't covered but that's burning for you that you want to share with the students before we open it up for questions?
No, I mean, I much rather respond to students' questions than keep on going with my monologue.
So, okay, yeah. So we have one question from Bradley. Even with all the work our private sectors have done, with our government withholding information from us and our president trying to open our economy back up, do you think we are working against each other?
Um, Well, I mean, if you say because, you know, government has done X, Y, Z, you're necessarily working against each other, it's a bit of a different question than sort of your mindset is, you know, working against each other. I don't think, like, I haven't seen, let's put this, but I haven't seen evidence that people are proactively or purposefully working against each other. It could very well be that, as you said correctly, you know, because government's response has been so odd, that we are hurting people as we're trying to help others. But again, you know, I would say that this is something that one can actually proactively work against by trying to identify these areas. I would be very interested in knowing if this person, Bradley, had a specific sort of situation in mind here. Did he say anything else about that?
No, Bradley, can you perhaps turn on your mic and respond?
Yeah, so with our economy right now and the president trying to open back up all businesses, there's a lot of talk about a potential boom in more cases down south, specifically like in the Texas, Florida area. Do you think it's going to end up working against us? Like if we try to push for everybody coming back to this normalization when we're not really this is a new precedent for everybody. And we're trying to treat it like it's the past. Do you think that's like a bad thing to do right now?
Oh, so you're referring to the opening up the economy. Is that right? Prematurely, perhaps. Yeah. I mean, again, you know, my gut feeling is I'm not an immunologist. My husband is, but I'm not. It's very difficult for me to sort of say what are the right and the wrong steps. In general, I feel that being like showing more sort of restraint at this time would be useful, it would be helpful. But I also understand, you know, you need to kind of weigh the benefits and the potential sort of losses of opening up certain parts of the economy or of the country earlier rather than later. But from what I've heard from scientists, both in the United States as well as in Europe, where things are also opening up, I should say. It is very dangerous to open up the country too quickly. And I mean, I can tell you, I said earlier, I go for walks with my son twice a day, but I always, you know, keep more than 2 feet apart, and I always wear my mask, and I will do so no matter, you know, what the policies are. I do not go anywhere where there are a lot of people. I won't fly anywhere anytime soon, and that is just, you know, me. But I think if we all sort of were to be responsible and sort of take a step back voluntarily, then these policies, the policies of opening up, could potentially work. I find it very, I don't know even what to say, disrespectful towards other humans, you know, to live one's life nowadays as if nothing happened. And, you know, again, I don't want to sort of get too close to anybody's or step on anybody's feelings here, but I don't understand why people would, you know, open up churches these days or, you know, large retail stores, as if theaters, as if nothing had happened. So yeah, I don't know. It's not a sort of clear cut answer to your question, but I think there's definitely a danger that we might be hurting ourselves, and we would be better off being a little bit hesitant for a longer time.
One aspect it could also open from an innovation perspective is, you know, are we craving so much to go back to the status quo that we've been accustomed to and that we are used to, instead of actually putting innovative forces into motion to figuring out what could actually be, you know, a different model that perhaps in the end might serve us differently.
I absolutely agree. I think that brings me back to my earlier comment. This is the moment, you know, this is an opportunity. This is a window of opportunity. And now is the moment when we can say, you know, we don't want things to continue this way. You know, we don't want to go back to what we have. And if we open, that's the other thing, if we open up things prematurely, again, you know, being very aware that the life of many people depends on this, you know, then we kind of miss the opportunity for innovation and change.
Okay, we had one long question from Thomas. I'm just going to try to read it. It's globalization has led to increasing connections between countries at many levels, including air travel, as well international manufacturing and shipping. Due to this pandemic, many international companies have struggled to find the means of doing everyday business as factories or offices in different nations find conflicts between government policies that were put in place to stem the virus. I have found many consumers dissatisfied with these systems, and many have started to seek out more and more local sources for products and services. What effect do you think this will have on people's dependence on bigger international corporations as opposed to smaller local companies? That's a great question.
Very interesting, yeah. Again, you know, this actually relates to the previous question. It depends. I'm not a psychic. I can't foretell the future, but I believe that more, the longer the time window we have to get accustomed to a new lifestyle, you know, and that includes sort of local, engaging with the local economy, perhaps even, you know, being an active part of it, contributing to it, the more likely we see long-lasting change. That being said, I mean, I don't want to say that sort of globally operating organizations are necessarily bad, you know. Like globalization overall, you know, can have, has in fact a lot of benefits to it, you know. But it's the question of how we organize this and how these globally operating companies, multinational organizations, operate and how their supply chains were, you know, where they pay taxes. There are so many, where they pay taxes. There are so many questions that are sort of related to that, that it's, I want to be careful. I think that's my point. I want to be careful not to sort of paint a picture where sort of the local economy is obviously so much better than the sort of internationally linked economy, you know. But we want to make sure that we establish best practices and a sort of awareness no matter where we go, in which direction.
Okay, there is another question coming in from Ved. The latest numbers we have from the Bureau of Labor Statistics is an unemployment rate of 14.7%. And I've read that the true unemployment is actually closer to 20% as of April. While some of these jobs will return after the economy reopens, how do you think that this crisis could affect the labor market long term, especially since a huge number of small businesses will likely close permanently? That's a great question, too.
Yeah. Very, very important point. So I think here it is again very interesting to look at the scenarios in different countries in a sort of comparative way. And I should probably preface everything I'm going to say by a really crucial point, namely we don't know how long this crisis will last, right? There's a lot of wishful thinking by certain politicians in particular, you know, who say, oh, it's going to be over by June 14th or 24th or whatever it is, you know, but crisis doesn't work that way, or the virus doesn't work this way. So a lot of the consequences that we're going to see and sort of the responses that governments have taken in order to address these consequences will only show in the future as to whether to which extent they were successful or sort of served a purpose. That being said, if we look at the current policies that exist with regard to government responses that exist with regard to COVID-19, we see, for instance, the short-term work policies in Europe are very much targeted. Now, sort of getting into COVID-19 responses, I didn't anticipate that, but we very much see that they are targeted so that employees stay on the books of companies and are actually not becoming unemployed. They usually have a reduction in their work hours. In Germany, we call this Kurzarbeit, for instance. And then obviously, you know, they lose a large chunk of their salary, but the government tops it up, not to 100%, but to around 80% or 60%. And then depending on sort of your family constellation or whether you're part of a union, for instance, up to 80%. Oh, I think 85 actually doesn't really matter. But anyway, so the important point here is the people are not unemployed they're not becoming unemployed under this short-term work scheme. And it's very easy for them to get back into the job market or into the workforce, because they stay in the workforce, if you want, after the crisis is over. Now, if you compare this to, and the picture is obviously even more, much more complicated. There's a lot of sort of cross mechanisms that play a role in ensuring that training is also, you know, sort of being provided. The French government, for instance, is just thinking about, making a significant amount of money available to people to sort of retrain, reskill. Obviously, you know, this goes back to our initial point about who actually has sort of effort. Now, if you compare that to the United States, for instance, where the government has given has pursued a policy of giving loans to companies in order to sort of stay financially afloat. Well, really a lot of companies have accepted these loans, but they don't. Initially, they were targeted for a two-month period, and they didn't really have an sort of much of an incentive to keep workers sort of in the workforce. A lot of people, as you know, have been furloughed. A lot of people have actually applied for unemployment. In this way, it's going to be much more difficult to get them back into the job market. That being said, everything I say right now is, it's a small sort of section of a really big picture. And one thing that I find, is something really important to acknowledge on the other side, on the other hand, with regard to the United States, is people here are much more, willing or accustomed to changing jobs, and being unemployed and getting back into the workforce. In Europe, we often have a bit of a stigma associated with unemployment. While people might have been laid off here, faster with significant implications, obviously, including especially access to healthcare. My hope would be that once the economy keeps going again, they also get back into the workforce or into the job market more easily. But big questions, and I would sort of point you to sort of a literature publications coming up by my colleague here at MIT called Kathleen Thielen. She's a political economist, and she works a lot on these issues. And she's actually published a piece with a woman called Anke Hassel. I can send Monique the link in the Washington Post that compares the responses by the US and the some European governments that elaborates on all these aspects in much more detail than I can right now.
That would be great if you can share the link. We'll pass it on to the students. We have some more questions in the chat. One is from Jake, relating to what you were saying about workplaces and businesses adapting and remodeling their individual formula. What do you believe are the consequences when companies ignore the dangers of continuing business as usual instead of making these accommodations? And do you think companies will be forced to make these changes regardless of the individual company's belief towards the pandemic?
Yes, I think it depends a lot on sort of the customers, because whether a company will do X or Y or Z, a company is not an entity with a will, right? It responds to pressures by the environment. And the environment is obviously sort of customers or the outside environment policy, but also it's sort of the internal environment in terms of, workers. And that's why I said earlier, if we change our expectations about what companies ought to do, both as customers as well as the potential workforce, we have an opportunity to create change. If we miss that opportunity and again, go back to the status quo because somehow it worked, then we're not going to see any change, I believe. Because again, for most companies, it has worked.
Bradley is asking a general question about, you know, just from a governmental perspective and governance structure, you know, does it make sense to have, you know, one person at the top making a decision versus, you know, allowing, you know, folks, or it could also be from a company perspective, or would it be much more prudent to actually open up the floor to the workforce, for example, or to society to make elections about choices on how the future should unfold or how we should deal with the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a Democrat by nature. I believe in the wisdom of many rather than one. So I'm all for, you know, relying on other people, especially with regard to sort of, you know, information and knowledge gathering in the first place. Ultimately, you somehow have to implement decisions, right? So then, you know, it's a very broad question, but it depends on how you, you know, how you want to run a country, a company, whatever. But I think with regard to sort of the basic premise, the more information you can gather, the more people you can, you know, have to talk to each other, listen to each other in order to come up with solutions, the better. That's why I was advocating for, you know, works councils, for you know, bringing in workers' voice, for advocating for democracy, right? For multiple parties, to be honest, you know, because I don't think that having one party or even just two parties, you know, will necessarily bring about the right, whatever the right is anyways, you know, the most effective solution. And I think especially in the United States, you know, I have to say that this is, again, and I'm getting on very sort of slippery territory here, but I'm really surprised that a country with such a strong sort of democratic tradition and such an individualistic sort of approach to life also, where people really believe in individual freedom and in their ability to determine what is best for them, buys into a two-party system and into an electoral college. I know my history, you know, I know where this is coming from, but it is really surprising to me, I have to say.
One question. No, sorry, we have a little bit of a time lag because my internet seems to be fading a little bit. One question from Anne-Katrin before she had to head out. I'm curious about what you see the role of place being in the situation for the future. A strong sense of identity is assigned to specific offices or a specific campus and the related community, of course. And how does this sense of identity transform if the place is no longer as relevant? How is community created, or a sense of belonging, if work happens from home or socially distant?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And I mean, I understand I'm talking to a lot of architecture students, so this is an even more relevant question. And I would actually love to hear you guys' opinion. I think I could learn so much from you here. My two cents on this is that we can find identity in a lot of different ways. And maybe I'm also saying that as somebody who's, you know, lived in a lot of different places and who still loves her home, you know, back in Germany, and just sort of loves going back there. So I do have that sense of belonging when I go there. But I also found that it's absolutely possible to find belonging and identity in other ways, you know, in a mindset, in surrounding yourself with like-minded people, in ideas that you believe in ways of interacting, in activities of all sort of you know, kinds. So there's a lot of way to build identity. That being said, you know, I'm not saying, oh, you know, whatever, but I'm not denying the effect that space has on people. And I think it's probably ultimately, even I would be sort of speculating here, but it's somehow part of our nature as a human being that we identify with space easily. But again, you know, I would love to hear you guys' opinion on that, because I have my experiences and my sort of personal take on that, but you've probably studied this in depth, so please share with me all your insights.
Yeah, you can definitely put them in the chat if you would like to share some of your perspectives in that regard. Maybe in the meantime, we'll go to the next question, and as the responses are coming in, I'll share them with you. One question from Bet: a lot of countries like UK, Canada, etc., have been doing direct, consistent cash relief, either in universal basic monthly income or a percentage of worker paychecks. The US has only given $1,200 for Americans. Do you think countries doing direct cash relief have done a better job mitigating the economic issues of the pandemic? What can we learn from these countries, if anything?
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, I think studies will really sort of show us the effects of this. You know, I mean, there's no question that if we tie certain benefits only to, say, a specific nationality, that a lot of people sort of don't have access to that. That being said, I don't know if that is actually the case. I thought the American response was somehow tied to whether you're sort of a resident for tax purposes or something like that, rather than actually a citizen. But again, I'm not an expert on this field. Again, I think, I know this sounds like I'm sort of trying to divert here, but ultimately it comes down to studies to show what the impact of different policies is. Obviously, you know, I have a gut feeling about how governments should respond, you know, and to be honest, that boils down to help those who actually need it and who need it most, especially if or since resources are necessarily limited. But I would want to see studies on this first before I make, you know, a broad generalizing comment here.
Okay, we have one last question from Emma. You mentioned that now is the time to experiment and promote change, but many do not want things to change, and some have even gone as far as defying the government's mandates and putting many at risk. What is your opinion on how the US can begin to address those who are against these changes, or if anything can even be done to truly control for this? Can we even develop changeless responses that would be accepted by everyone?
Yeah, so I think it comes down to no response that you'll ever come up with will be accepted by everyone. Never. Like, even something that you think, well, this is so a no-brainer and this makes so much sense, you will always have people who say, for whichever reason, you know, usually it's some sort of self-interest, but it can also be a, you know, perfectly legitimate, you know, other sort of rationale. You will always find opposition. So I would sort of reframe that question and say, you know, how can we come up with solutions that are contributing most to overall societal well-being and actually are implementable with relatively little resistance? Or to put it differently, how do you find allies that you can work with as you are trying to put into place your specific idea or sort of vision for what the future looks like? And I think that is actually going back to sort of the initial topic of our conversation, universities and higher education institutions, as well as, you know, later workplaces. I think this is really where these institutions can, should, in my opinion, sort of should put their focus on. Namely, how can you facilitate interaction? And I mean, Monique is doing such a great job, or your entire team is doing such a great job, you know, bringing you guys together here in an online format. But how can you sort of push this even further and create a community where, you know, after, say, a talk like this, and maybe you guys are doing that already, you use other technologies and say, hey, do you remember this question was actually really interesting? And I have a feeling we could work well together. Why don't we, you know, follow up and set up another talk or a phone call or what have you, and develop an idea. And then from that sort of you snowball it out and think, okay, now it was just say the two of us, maybe you already know each other because you guys actually met each other before COVID-19 broke out. But, you know, future generations might not have that luxury. Again, it's a question of how do you facilitate community and the exchange of ideas in this new environment. And I think that is going to be the huge challenge, but I do believe that we can do it. And again, you know, so the new generation is so creative. And I really should say, you know, when I look at my students at MIT, the ideas they come up with is just mind blowing. And I'm sure it's the same here, you know? there's so much one can do, and technologies, you know, are actually they have a huge potential in that regard. It's not just sort of, you know, automation replacing people, but it also, you know, allows for you know, great advances. And the question is, how do we use technologies, right? How do we use them towards the greater good? And I think right now, again, this conversation actually shows that we can use them in a very proactive way. And hopefully you guys from this, you know, once this conversation is over, take the next steps and don't just say, oh, you know, that was hopefully interesting, you know, or man, I really should have gone for a run or whatever it is, you know, but, you know, take this to the next level. And I'm sure Monique and the team will help you.
Thank you so much, Emma, for an amazing wrap-up question. And thank you so much, Ines, for being here today. You were a fabulous mind opener. And, you know, one of the goals of this and next week is really to allow students to connect with people they otherwise would not necessarily meet as part of their disciplines, and to hear about topics that don't always synchronize easily with the discipline, because it will require them to really start to think about what is the interaction point between, you know, a space or how we would work or live in the future? And what does that mean in terms of city structures, in terms of how we have to think differently around our internal space structures? So I think it's becoming, you know, more and more, there are more and more opportunities that we can carve out. And so I appreciate you taking the time. The students after each of those talks are actually going back and diving deeper and figuring out what has globally happened and what kind of innovations have been, you know, already created globally based on some of those challenges that you have thrown out today, some of the ideas that you have thrown out today. And then they negotiate as a team what their top five will be that they advance for this particular segment of future of work, you know, by the end of this week. So I'd be more than happy to share those with you back, so you can potentially build on that and get some impulses as well. And for now, I thank you so much for being here and for taking the
time.
Thank
you.
Absolute pleasure. And again, I would actually love to hear back, you know, what your students are coming up with. Like, sounds so fascinating, and especially this sort of space, you know, component, something that I can only learn from you. So please share with me whatever you come up with. And feel free to reach out. Monique has my contact information, or you can just, you know, find me on MIT's website.
Sounds good. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Circle back, and I'll see you soon.
Bye. See you. Be safe.
Yeah. Bye.